Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello and welcome to the Intelligent Design the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. We have with us on the show today, once again, Dr. James Lefanu, the author of the new book, Why Us? How Science Rediscovered the Mystery of Ourselves, published just this year by Pantheon Books. It's a book that explores some of the deepest questions that are really hanging over the head of science today. What is the origin of biological complexity? How do we get from the electrochemistry of our brain to the mind? What is the genetic basis for the complexity that we see in our own bodies? And can natural selection, acting on random mutations, account for these features? And these are, of course, topics that are of profound interest to all of us as humans. We talk about them a lot here at the Discovery Institute. And so, Dr. Lefanu, we're absolutely honored to have you with us, calling from London today on the show with us.
Well, glad to be able to join you.
We're continuing our discussion today about why us. And of course, in the last podcast, we talked about how Dr. Lefanu got interested in the topical biological origins, how he's not just a medical doctor who studied medicine at Cambridge University and the Royal London Hospital, but he also is a well-written author. He writes for the Sunday and Daily Telegraph. He's written for the New Statesman, the Spectator, GQ, the British Medical Journal, the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine, and has written other books as well, including The Rise and Fall of Modern Science, that won the Los Angeles Book Prize Award in 2001. So you're quite an accomplished author, Dr. Lefanu, in quite a good position, I think, to communicate science to the public, which is, of course, something that gets talked about quite a bit these days. Our critics like to talk about scientific literacy. I think that you are helping to resolve and end the problem of scientific literacy. However, probably not in the direction that many of the evolutionist critics of our viewpoint would like. So what has been the reception to your book since you published it?
Well, it has been favorably reviewed, and it's helped me well here in England, I'm glad to say, and it's fallen on stony ground in certain predictable circles. The science journals don't like it and have tended not to review it. For that reason, I mean, I'd like to think they don't, because you know, to do it is to bring attention to, you know, the seriousness of the arguments or the challenge it poses to prevailing scientific view. I think, well, I'd like to think that the questions it raises will not go away. We are on the cusp of this very, very interesting moment. The subtext of the book is, or the subtitle is, How Science Rediscovered the Mystery of Ourselves. And essentially it is about how this is not a challenge to contemporary scientific view from a sort of theological or necessarily a philosophical point of view, although of course it does have both theological and philosophical implications. The challenge comes from within science itself. It's the onward march of science, and particularly genetics and neuroscience in the last 20 years, have posed the most serious challenge to the common prevailing assumptions, particularly the all-encompassing Darwinian evolutionary theory.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit. You actually spent quite a bit of time in your book reviewing, and I thought quite lucidly, the evidence regarding human evolution from the fossil record. So I'd like to read a short quote. You say on page 58, "The discrepancy between the beguiling simplicities of evolutionary theory and the profundity of biological phenomena it seeks to explain is very striking. Its claims can never be put to the test of experimental verification. There is no way of telling one way or the other whether the process of natural selection really does account for those extraordinary biological events millions of years ago. The standard evolutionary explanation is, in short, irrefutable, or was irrefutable, until the uncompromising verdict of the genome projects, where random genetic mutations that might set us apart from our primate cousins, mice, flies, or worms, are nowhere to be found," unquote. How does your book address this question of the inability of natural selection and random mutations to really account for the complexity that we see in our bodies?
Right. Well, to put it as simply and as concisely as possible, It's a story of the ascent of man from our primate cousins to ourselves. It is, as we know, incredibly plausible, and it is reinforced by a whole series of, you know, really powerful images, and has moved from being, as it were, a theoretical question to a quite specific one. And you begin to ask the question, you know, well, what actually happened? What was actually entailed in this process? And it's quite, and it makes you realize that actually, you know, the difference between our nearest primate cousins and ourselves are, for all the similarities, enormously different. It involves essentially a whole-scale redesign of a human body. 300 at least separate anatomical changes have to take place. Completely novel, absolutely never-before attribute of the brain, like the faculty of language or the appreciation of music or the ability to understand the mathematics and so on and so on. One comes up against, and this is my point about science rediscovering the mystery of ourselves, one comes up against the major, extraordinary, completely unexpected findings of genetics in the recent past and the ability to spell out all the genes strung out along the double helix. And the realization that essentially our genomes, our genes, are interchangeable with those of our primate cousins to the tune of 98 or 99%. Obviously, in one sense, this is, as it were, favors the argument of common descent, that there is obviously some relationship between ourselves and our primate cousins. But what it does do is it completely refutes the notion that this incredible biological complexity, these can be accounted for in solely in terms of natural selection acting on the random mutation of genes. Because the question is, if that is the case, where are they? Where are these genes? Mm. Where are the random mutations? How do you begin to account for a phenomena which is standing upright and acquiring a particularly-sized brain, which in itself is so counter to the best interests, or as it were, the survival of, you know, the natural survival of our species. Because unless one has, as it were, the full set of those anatomical changes which allow us to stand upright, then you are, by definition, incredibly vulnerable as you teeter across the savannah to, you know, any passing predator. And the point about it is that one moves from a situation where we thought, or science thought, or the general view held, that we sort of know the answer to that, to the recognition that actually we really have no idea at all. And that is a very extraordinary situation to find ourselves in. But what it does do, I think, what I think is really important about it, is that it makes you realize, or brings you face to face, with just how profound these matters are. These are incredibly fascinating, incredibly interesting things have happened. Are well worth meditating on. You know, fill one with thought, awe, and imagination, and admiration. But the problem about, you know, the standard evolutionary explanation is that it sort of presupposes that the argument is closed, all quite straightforward, and we all know the answer. Mm. And in so doing, it drains its fundamental question, which must be, of our origins, drains it of its interest and its fascination, its intellectual interest and fascination, and makes it appear as if it were some sort of banality.
I couldn't agree with you more, and if I can just read a very eloquent quote from your book to give our listeners another teaser here, where you talk about this subject. You say, from an evolutionary perspective, while our near equivalence of the human genome to that of our primate cousins would certainly confirm our common ancestral heritage, beyond that, every finding, the paucity of genes, their multitasking, those shared master genes, is a nail in the coffin of Darwin's proposed mechanism of natural selection acting on numerous small random genetic mutations, unquote. And you provide just a myriad of examples to support this case against, you know, a Darwinian account of the origin of our biological features. And I think that this is a very, very compelling case that you put together.
The research on genetics has taught us about, you know, evolutionary story of man is that, you know, that obviously, A, it's much more complex than we recognize, and secondly, that we don't understand the mechanism. I mean, we don't know how it is that we evolved. It might be that we had evolved from our primate cousins, but we don't know how it happened. And the same thing applies essentially to the whole diversity of life. But there's something further that one has to get further into here, and that is that what one has come up against is essentially the what you call the incommensurability, the non-correlation between the monotonous sequence of the chemical genes strung out along the double helix, which, as we all know, are just a series of four chemicals arranged in a particular sequence, and the enormous richness of the diversity of form and attributes of the living world. That is, obviously, in a sense, the genetic instructions have to be there in the double helix. But how you get from, essentially, the same genes that we share with our primate cousins and ourselves to, you know, the chimpanzee or humans, what it is in those genes which conjures from these genes this enormous richness and diversity, unbelievable diversity of form and attributes of the living world. I mean, that is what genetics has, as it were, brought to our attention incredibly forcibly. The point about the double helix and the genes is that it appears a very simple structure, because it has to be simple in order to replicate the genetic instructions every time the cell divides. It has to be a single sequence of chemicals, because otherwise it couldn't do that. But it's the very fact that it has to be simple in order to replicate these instructions, which makes one realize, you know, how deeply, deeply inscrutable the whole phenomenon of the double helix is. Because it means that somehow or other, the form and attributes in all forms of life have to be condensed within that sequence of genes. And that is something which, as it were, lies far beyond the powers of science to explain at the moment, and it would seem likely indefinitely. And what it does is it brings to your attention that old notion that, you know, is around in the mid-19th century, which a lot of biologists before Darwin maintained, is that there are non-material forces operating within biology, things that you can't necessarily measure, you can't pin them down, but we operate within the genes and within the cell and within the whole organism to bring it into being, and which, you know, make possible this vast diversity of forms that so readily distinguish flowers from octopuses, from mice, from flies, and so on and so on. And it's a really, really interesting thing there, because just as the recent finding of genetics have focused our attention on what is actually involved in the evolutionary process of the ascent of man, it also, you know, even more dramatically, it brings to our attention the deep inscrutability of what the nature of those genetic instructions and how they can bring life into being. We are really, you know, it's a really interesting thing that we've actually moved in a very short period of time from thinking that in a sense we knew the answer to that question to really recognizing that we don't. And so when one is confronted by something very simple like a tulip or a snowdrop or something like that, essentially one's back into that situation where one begins to think, you know, how can these things be? You know, what is it that accounts for this? Because certainly, you know, the conventional scientific answer doesn't begin to get within a million miles of it.
One question I'd like to ask you, because this often comes up in questions that we receive and that people bring up, is the classical explanation for the evolution of the eye that is found in many textbooks. And you talked about how once you sort of admit that there are certain holes in your theory, or that perhaps, you know, our explanation is a little bit simplistic, well, the bottom sort of falls out. Did you find the classical explanation for the evolution of the eye that you talk about in your book from the perspective of a medical doctor, did you find that convincing, or is it lacking in some details, perhaps?
For the classic evolutionary explanation for the evolution of the eye.
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's nonsense. I mean, it's an absurdity. I mean, all that happens, I mean, what they say is that they arrange a series of eyes, starting from the simple to the ever more complex, and the suggestion that, you know, one evolves into another. But these different eyes different types of eye are themselves taken from simple and ever more complex features. So they only reflect the fact that the more complex you are, the more complex your eye. The nature that, as it were, one form of eye, simple eye, evolves into a more complex one is non-substantiated, because the standard explanation takes a series of eyes from a group of organisms called mollusks. And mollusks range everything from a limpet, terribly simple, all the way to a complex octopus. And each of these series of creatures, the more sophisticated it becomes, the more sophisticated their eye becomes. Now, if the standard evolutionary story is true, then that would mean that actually a limpet evolves into an octopus, which it doesn't. All these different sorts of eyes of ever greater complexity reflect the fact that in the biological world and within the province of the mollusks, that some mollusks are very simple and others, like octopuses, are very complex.
Well, we still have to talk about the other fundamental question of your book, the adequacy of materialistic attempts to explain the mind. So we'll have to go into that one on another podcast. But let me just say that our hope is that the scientific community will no longer be able to ignore your book. And whether they give a good reviews or bad ones, whether they like what you're saying or not, that it will force them to start confronting these profound questions of life and humanity. And perhaps your book will add a little dose of humility to the self-confident assurances we often hear from them that materialistic science can provide all the answers. So thank you once again, Dr. Lefanu, for your time and for doing this podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for asking me.
I'm Casey Luskin with the ID of the Future podcast. Stay tuned for more with Dr. James Lefanu and his book, Why Us?
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.